Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Snow Goose Theater in Anchorage, where Bioneers in Alaska hosted Ricky Ott on December 9, 2009. A marine biologist and former commercial fisherman, Ricky Ott experienced the Exxon Valdez oil spill firsthand in 1989, which led her to become a citizen activist in an effort to protect the environment, everyday people, and their livelihood. Today, Ricky Ott is a published author, scientist, activist, and public speaker. On Wednesday, December 9th, while in Anchorage, she spoke on Democracy in Crisis. It's time to change the rules.
Hello, everybody. My name is Mark Masteller with Bioneers in Alaska, with Cascadia Green Building Council, etc. And I really appreciate everybody coming on a foggy Wednesday in the valley. It's beautiful out there. Okay, Ricky Ott came to us from Cordova, but she's been traveling, I think she said 240 days this year, so who knows where she was recently. But we're really pleased that Ricky could be in Anchorage tonight. And Ricky's been an activist for a long time in the Cordova area on several issues, but of course, written a couple good books about the oil spill, etc. And I won't go into a long introduction. Ricky can fill you in. But several years ago, in 2004, which is the first year we did a Bioneers in Alaska conference, we had a presenter on the big screen named Tom Lindsay, and he was talking about corporations versus democracy. And I was thrilled, and I remember sitting next to Pam Miller and Ellie Vandevis, and I said, we got to do a democracy school in Alaska. In 2005, we did that, and it's intimately connected with what we're going to see tonight, because a lot of the things we work on when it comes to conservation issues ends up being a corporate power or a democracy issue in the big picture. So I know Ricky has gone way more into this than I've ever gone into it, and she's studied this and gone to the trainings for Democracy School, etc. So I'm really thrilled, and everybody welcome Ricky Ott.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks you all. Thanks to Bioneers for making me think of the bigger picture. The Lindsay chapter, by the way, is the very last chapter of my second book on the environmental crisis, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, showing how it merged into a democracy crisis. And that is what we're going to be talking about tonight, the democracy crisis. We are at, there's two ways to look at where we are in our history as a civil society and as a on a planet, okay, with limited resources. One way is to say it's all crumbling, it's all falling apart, we're doomed. The other way to say, look at it, is to say, isn't this an exciting time to be alive? Because we have some very fundamental choices to make, and we have to make them very soon. And just how are we going to do this? I mean, let's pretend like we are going to do something, right? So I actually have been on the road for 2.5 months in the lower 48, doing a lot of information gathering and awareness raising, and I have some really good stories to report. I want to start actually with this. This happens to be the Power Shift students. The Power Shift students are university students across 1,500 campuses that are committed to getting off fossil fuels. Power Shift. It's not only the physical energy power that they want to shift, they also are talking about political power. But when I was speaking in Eugene to the Power Shift, at the Power Shift rally, we started with this rallying cry, no coal, no oil, no compromise. And so I asked, no coal, no oil, no compromise. Have you thought about the no compromise part? How are you going to get to that? And they hadn't. And I pointed out to them that we're trying to do a couple other things right now as a people, like healthcare reform, the public option. Well, we're seeing our Congress, our supposedly publicly elected officials, sort of mincing, making Swiss cheese out of health care reform. And the energy people are watching, and they're modeling their approach very similar to what the big pharma and big insurance companies are doing with lobbying Congress. Our Clean Energy Jobs Act has a parallel act introduced by the American Petroleum Institute called the Creating Economic Reform Through Energy Jobs Act, acronym CREATE Jobs Act. You notice the word clean sort of vanished from that. And it's about requiring oil development basically everywhere. So climate crisis, and as we, you know, the lingo is COP15. COP15 is Copenhagen 15. The anticipation, the hope for Copenhagen was that we would see some real change, was that we would see some fundamental structural moves towards transitioning in a serious way off fossil fuels. And now we're hearing, one thing, if you happen to read Palin's article, that, oh, it's all just those goofy climate scientists. But the other thing we're hearing is that pretty much we're not going to get anything meaningful out of COP15. We don't have time not to get something meaningful. What's going on? Economic meltdown, mortgage foreclosures and lost pensions, Wall Street and the big three bailouts. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And really what this is what I call the face of the democracy crisis. If I had to draw this out as a graphic, this is, I think, what it would look like. The American flag blending into money. This is the merger of democracy and capitalism. This is where I think we as a people fundamentally went wrong with some of our choices. Democracy and capitalism blended, meaning the same thing. What's good for capitalism is good for democracy. What's good for GE is good for America. Remember that? Okay, so let's take a look more in depth at what is this democracy crisis, and in particular, what can we do about it? And I just want to I only have two oil spill slides in this whole talk. This is a record for me. But just in case some folks here don't know who I am living in Cordova. At least that's the only house that I have. In my heart, I live in Cordova. And 20 years ago, on March 24th, 1989, the Exxon Valdez spilled somewhere between 11 to 30 million gallons of oil in our fishing ground, our backyard. Well, the next 20 years, we spent trying to fix that. And what we're left with is basically still a big mess. We have wrecked economy, wrecked environment, wrecked lives, wrecked community. Our beaches still have plenty of oil. I take high school students out now usually when I'm around in March. We dig a pit, pour water in. And the students being students, they put their gloved hand in there and out it comes with oil. So any flood tide brings this to the surface. This oil is accessible to the ecosystem, to the animals, to the wildlife. I mean, how did things come to this? How did it come where corporations could come in and cause this much damage and then go on, business as usual, and leave all of us to pick up the pieces, externalize the risk to the people and the environment and the communities? What happened? So we kind of had the democracy crisis up front and personal in Cordova way before it hit the rest of the nation as economic meltdown. And in Cordova, we really started asking the question, what happened as our lawsuit, you know, started playing out over two decades, year after year. We kept hoping Exxon would make things right, make good on their promise to make us whole. So we started asking, how did corporations get so big where they could manipulate the legal system, the political system, our government? What happened? And I went, you know, I don't know. So I took 2 years to research it, and this is the Lindsay saga, segue, if you will, because one of the first things I did was take a class with Thomas Lindsay. And then I took two more on different topics, and then I branched out on my own. And what we're going to do here is go back and revisit what we think we have, okay? How we think our government works, And what we think we have, and as I talk to the children in schools, I speak now from fourth grade all the way through universities, and that our high school and middle school students are literally being taught that we have three branches of government: a legislature that makes law, a judiciary that interprets the law, and an executive branch that enforces the law. There's a system of checks and balances, and we, the people, are the ultimate check and balance on this system of sovereign self-governance. That's what we are taught we have. But we no longer have this. What we have is the illusion of this. And this sovereign self-governance or democracy, I kind of say, is like Oz, okay? Where you have this wonderful curtain that says, democracy. But if you peek behind the curtain, you'll find that other hands are operating the levers of our government, okay? So let's peek, okay? We're going to ask some fundamental questions. And one of the first questions I asked the fifth grade, I just did this with a fifth grade class in Santa Barbara. And I said, what are the first three words of the U.S. Constitution? And you know what? The fifth graders knew that. So these little squeaky voices said, we the people, right away. And then I said, who are people? Absolute aghast silence. They just looked at me. And finally, one little boy jabs his thumb in his chest and he says, we. So that's my new definition of real people. We, okay? It turns out, under law, there's actually two types of people. Natural persons, or we, and what's the other type? Artificial persons. Technically, artificial persons. So we have natural persons. This is a legal term, okay? Natural persons and artificial persons. And corporations are a form of artificial person. And they are organized as under charters so that they can do a number of things, like own property, have contracts, sue or be sued, basically do business as a group of people. And they are literally recognized as artificial persons. And I'm kind of symbolizing them as this little corporate with a head and feet. So we have this artificial person figure, okay? Now, here's another fundamental question. Who drafted our Constitution? Okay? It was we, but it was a subset of we, I think, as everybody knows. It wasn't the 80% of the population. It was a very wealthy, propertied class of men, white. And so it was not the common people who drafted our Constitution. When we wrote we the people, it was leaving out about 80%, okay? Instead, it was the wealthy ruling minority. And the wealthy ruling minority wrote a constitution to a second constitution, okay? The second one now. I'm not talking about the first one. I'm talking about the one we have now. That one is a property and commerce document. It protects property. It protects the wealth of the wealthy minority that wrote the document. It protects it so much that, let me just add here that our Constitution is what's called a negative rights document. In other words, it does not grant human rights. The human rights have to be written in. There's only one other country with a negative rights document as a constitution. And if you've seen Michael Moore's movie Capitalism, you know what it is. So we'll loop back. Well, do you know? No, don't fare if you've seen that movie. Do you know what it is? No? Yes? No? Iran, because we helped write the Constitution. We are exporting democracy, okay? Okay, I'm getting ahead of the story. Negative rights document. In fact, it is such a negative rights document that when the people, the other 80%, actually saw what had been written, people went, what about some basic rights for people? So there was a very hastily drafted Bill of Rights that added in some fundamental rights for people. And that was the first Bill of Rights. Now, what the drafters of the Constitution did was they allocated power. On one side, they put "we the people," now in quotes, because we know kind of what that means. And for people, they gave people rights, they made people sovereign and private. On the other side of the equation, we put government and corporations. Both of these entities, government and corporations, we held accountable to the people. We made them public, and we gave them duties. Corporations, as a business entity, we also gave some privileges, limited liability, some other things, perpetual life. But the point is that it was all very transparent at the beginning of our country's, of our founding. And it was transparent because we had just fought the American Revolution. And people were very wary of the monarchy and the money. So people wanted to be in control, wanted to be in charge of those two entities. So corporations, for example, were chartered. And I'm talking, there weren't very many corporations at the time. That was not a very common way of doing business. Maybe a couple dozen. There really weren't very many. But these corporations were chartered by the state legislatures, and the books were transparent. Charters could be revoked. They were chartered for a public purpose for a very limited time. Perpetuity came later. And when the railroad was built, the bridge was built, the canal was built, whatever, the corporation was disbanded, and people went on about their business. So corporations, there's a book called Gangs of America, which I think every adult in America should read, that tells this story that I'm telling you. But in story form. And what we have here is Ted Nace, the author of that book, summarizes up our 200-plus years of history by saying that there was a blurring of rights that occurred as time passed and people grew less wary of big corporations and big government. And corporations became more common as a business form. And what we saw was this blurring of rights occurred in three phases. One phase was where the state legislature started to relax. And it started to give more and more privileges to these corporations, this corporate form. That was the first 100 years. Roughly the next 100 years, corporations received rights. Now I'm talking rights, not privileges, through the courts. And the difference between rights and privileges is like if you're a parent and you have a kid. The kid has privileges. They can't vote. They can't. Those are rights. Okay, there's a difference. Privileges are one thing. We are in charge of doling out privileges. Rights makes them equal to us. Finally, the third phase is kind of where we're at now, which is corporations now have so many rights that they've just kind of can actually dispense with going through courts and just go and overwrite human rights through global trade agreements. This is where we're at now. So this is kind of, that was the overview statement. We're going to go back now to our founders and do a little bit of chronology here. So we have legislatures that are controlling corporations and the government. And people are in control of the government and corporations. Corporations started to want more power. And the first time that the word corporation was sort of found in our Constitution actually was 1819 under a challenge to the chartering. This led and the Supreme Court actually ruled in favor of, it turns out it was the college, Dartmouth College, ruled in favor of the college and found the word corporations in a document, the Constitution, that did not ever say corporation. The word person is listed 34 times in our Constitution and Bill of Rights. The word person. The word corporation never shows up in those documents, okay? But the Supreme Court interpreted to mean that the Constitution also applied to corporations. This led Thomas Jefferson to say, our country, 3 years later, our country is now taking so steady a course as to show by what road it will pass to destruction, to wit, by consolidation of power first, and then by corruption, its necessary consequence. The engine of consolidation will be the federal judiciary. The other two branches, the corrupting and corrupted instruments. The engine of consolidation will be the federal judiciary. What happened? The thing about, I just want to say one more thing about our founders. And that is, when you create something, you know what its strengths are and what its weaknesses are. And in this case, we have not just Jefferson, this is just a quote that I chose, but a lot of our founders are warning, watch out, our weakness, the weakness, how we can destroy what we have created is through the federal judiciary. Okay? So this will become clear in a second here. We have time passing now. We have people, that 80% that was left out, starting to agitate for rights. So we have the Civil War happening. We have the suffragettes happening. And we also have, at the same time, corporations are becoming more and more powerful because they have to build the railroads for industry. They have to supply munitions for the Civil War. They have to build army uniforms. So they're becoming more and more powerful. And actually, it was after the Civil War, when the Civil Rights Amendments passed, that corporations saw their chance to really seize power. This was in the form of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment is about due process and equal protection for African American men. And here we see this word person again. Nor shall any state deny to any persons within its jurisdiction the equal protection of laws. Well, corporations went, there it is. And the first 20 years after this 14th Amendment passed, there were 307 lawsuits brought, of which 19 were by African American men. The other 288 were all by corporations trying to become persons in the eyes of the law, trying to get equal protection for artificial persons and human persons, no difference. So finally, in 1886, in Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, the U.S. Supreme Court granted a corporation equal protection under the law. It gave a corporation human rights. And when you give it to one corporation, you immediately give it to all of them, okay? So at this point, this is where I say our little corporate person now actually captured the flag. They are the same as us, artificial persons and human persons, anytime the court rules so. So the corporation started going after more rights. And before I talk about the demise of our democracy here, I want to say that in this instant, in 1886, literally, power was reallocated. We the people on one side of the equation, sovereign, private, with rights. What this Supreme Court decision did was it shifted the corporations out of the government side and shifted them over to our side. People and corporations, same. Sovereign, rights, and private. So corporations retained the privileges that they had already up to this point. What this decision has allowed since 1886 is a fantastic consolidation of wealth and power that is basically what's destroying. It's overwhelmed people and is destroying our democratic process. That's what's going on. Hence, so the way I illustrate that is like we the people are shrinking and corporate voice is growing louder and louder. Now, other presidents saw what was going on and began to worry about we the people, the real we, okay? Is that fifth grader said? Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in his second after his second inaugural speech, actually introduced a second Bill of Rights. And this was actually brought out in Michael Moore's movie Capitalism with some incredible video footage of this. And the second Bill of Rights included things like the right to a living wage, adequate medical care, a decent home, adequate food, and a good education. This never came to pass because, you know, he died. But what happened was his wife, Eleanor, took those principles and as chair of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, basically enshrined those very same principles in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. At this point, 155 nations have signed off on this Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But in our country, we've branded it socialism, and we haven't passed this. 155 countries, and we haven't done this. Instead, we took another route. We took the capitalism route. And here is, actually, this is a very late example of corporate hijacking of our democracy through the Supreme Court. I'm going to focus on the First Amendment because we have a very important case coming up, and it's supposed to be ruled before the end of this year, probably by next week. This is under the First Amendment. The First Amendment hijacking started in 1976 when the Supreme Court ruled that corporations have such a thing called commercial speech. It's a chip out of our First Amendment protection. And the corporate speech is about free speech equals money. We saw how that worked in Exxon Valdez. We don't make $40-plus billion of profit. So when you have that kind of money, there is no such thing as free speech. Political speech. Political speech in 1978, the Supreme Court ruled that political speech is protected. In particular, corporations can spend unlimited money to speak to ads to overturn citizen referendums. Citizen referendums, our very basic tool of, you know, making law. 1986, there was another chip. That chip under the First Amendment was negative speech. Negative speech is about the right not to speak. And it's being used, for example, like by food companies that don't want to label their product as GMO, genetically modified organisms food, because it's, you know, Monsanto et al. Has become aware that GMO is a trigger and people won't buy it if they have a choice. So where we're at right now is corporations like Monsanto can claim negative speech, their right not to label, not to speak, and they are now suing organic farmers because organic farmers are putting non-GMO food labels, and that implies that other food might have it. That's where we're at with this. It gets worse. 2003, we have false speech. False speech is about, well, in this case, it was Nike doing something differently in third world countries than their corporate code of ethics that they proclaimed in public they were doing. And in this case, basically it's settled, but it allows corporations to basically lie in ads. So let the buyer beware, okay? This is false speech, protected. And now here we are with Citizens Unlimited and something called robust speech. And robust speech is about unlimited campaign contributions. In other words, this would open the floodgates to corporate money to electioneering, in everything from school boards to the president and everything in between, zoning commissions, state office, federal office, judges, everything, unlimited campaign spending. The constitutional scholars are saying that this is the worst assault on our democracy to date. Okay? And it doesn't look good for the ruling, I might add. On the website, ultimatecivics.org, there's a list of all the other amendments that have been usurped by corporations. But I'm just going to do a summary here because these all went down through the Supreme Court. This is all about consolidation of power through the Supreme Court. Fourth Amendment. The corporations usurped Fourth Amendment, which is about search and seizure. So imagine our federal agencies having to go knock on doors of either corporate polluters or suspected violations of food processing, worker safety. Knock, knock. Oh, sorry, you don't have a warrant. You have to come back later. Right. Right. Like you're gonna. So this has weakened our federal agency's ability to enforce our laws. Fifth Amendment is about due process and takings, adequate compensation if the government had to take property. Well, now it's if corporations take it. And corporations have flipped it around so that they can take. So this is about things like split estate, where corporations can take coal, oil, if it's under your property, if it's under your ranch, if it's under your house. We had a farmer, a rancher, four-generation rancher. He must have been in his 70s, in tears in Fort Lewis when I gave a talk there, because he didn't know what to do. The oil boys had come in. They'd found oil on their half of his property, and they were just taking it. He strapped himself to his own gate, and he literally didn't know what to do. There's a movie out called Split Estate, by the way. Sixth Amendment and Seventh Amendment, those are about right to a jury trial in a criminal and civil case. I mean, we shouldn't even be in court fighting these huge, giant corporations. It is not equal protection under the law when it's such a huge imbalance going in. So, coming soon, guess what the constitutional scholars are saying? Okay, this is a real shocker. Second Amendment, which is right to bear arms. So picture this. Ronald McDonald with an Uzi. But really, we're talking here about things like Blackwater, right? But this is what the constitutional scholars are saying is on the horizon. No kidding. Okay, so let's look at our history for the, you know, past couple of centuries and the process of acquiring rights. People acquire rights through long, drawn-out battles, you know, civil disobedience, marches on the streets, protests, very long, usually a couple generations. Corporations, all they have to do to acquire rights is go to the Supreme Court. Over and done with. There was not even a debate on the issue of whether corporations should have the same rights as persons in the 14th Amendment. The court just said, we are of the opinion that they have them. That was 1886. No public debate. So we don't have what we thought we had, which is a sovereign self-governance. What is it that we have? I think we're going back to where we have blurred democracy and capitalism. And this is, I referred to it earlier, this is about Charlie Wilson, of the CEO of General Motors, when he said, you know, what's good for America is good for General Motors and vice versa. We believe that. We believe that. Where has that led us? That has led us to, and this is, again, this is the politest thing I can call this, is a corpocracy, okay? This is this merger of business and government, business with our government. They have to, it's about molding the economy around, molding our democracy around how well we do economically. And this is about the value of making money. Specifically, our economy is measured by money exchanging hands. Actually, the invisible government is the hands behind the curtain saying democracy. So let's take a look at what makes our economy grow right now. When we hear the words, it's good for the economy, the gross national product is up, what does that mean? Well, for example, in the state of Alaska, the Exxon Valdez oil spill cleanup boosted the entire gross domestic product for the state in 1989 because there was such an influx of wealth. So does that mean that oil spills are good for the economy? Yes, it does. Yes, it does. War profiteering. good for the economy the way we measure it. More wars, the better we are. Incarceration. Where do corporations get really cheap labor in America? Prisons. Sick people. This is about money exchanging hands. Oh, sorry, incarceration was also about privatizing jails, making a business out of it. Sick people. Sick people are good for the economy. Why? Because they have to buy medicine, they have to buy health care, they have to buy whatever they can to try to stay healthy. Money exchanging hands, good for the economy. So the way it looks is, in a corporocracy, the gross domestic product, money grows at the expense of social and environmental capital. It's about growing our economy and consuming our social wealth and our environmental wealth. Author David Corton calls this a suicide economy. There is no end to this model. We can keep growing our economy until there's no more planet, and we can keep saying it's good for business. There is no check and balance on this system. So, how do we get a check and balance on it? Let's go back to this idea of separating democracy and capitalism. We already know about corporate values, money, making money. That's it. If we're going to separate democracy and capitalism, let's separate the artificial person and the real people, the fake people and the real people, and let's look at the difference in values between fake people and real people. Fake people, it's all about making money, and that's fine for a business. Businesses should be about bottom line. Fine, no problem there. The problem comes with, are business values really the same as human values? Let's take a closer look at that. And this is where I usually give people 3 minutes to write, okay? But since I forgot to ask you to bring a sheet of paper, you're going to have to do this as a mental exercise, okay? So I'm going to give you a little sheet here and just show you, because I'm going to ask you guys, what are some of your values here in just a second. When I did this with a class of the fifth grade class, this is what we came up with, and I've done it with actually fifth, middle school, elementary school, and high school. This is what the kids come up with. Best friends, mom and dad, my home, my cat or dog or animals, ocean, mountains, water, surfboard, peace. I was in California a lot, okay? That's where the surfboard came from. And candy, okay? And so I forgot to say that the question that I pose to kids is, what is it that you like? What makes you happy? What do you love? And then they have a big piece of butcher paper, and they go for it for 3 minutes. And I have little questions. Do we have to write in full sentences? No. Do we have to spell right? No. Just write. You only have 3 minutes. So it's amazing what kids can produce in 3 minutes. All kinds of artwork. And then they talk about it, you know. And we share what everybody's written. And then I say, okay, well, let's think about this a little bit. This is the talk I give for the kids is titled, Not the Democracy Crisis. I don't need to scare the kids. It's entitled, Protecting What We Love. So we have to identify what we love, right? And I say, so, you know, when you go to a grocery store and you're buying something, it comes with a label, a price tag, a sticker that says how much it's worth. So do your best friends have a sticker on their head that says how much they're worth? And the kids all go, no. And I say, do your mom or dad? Giggle, giggle, giggle. No. And I say, okay, trick question. Does your surfboard? Yes. Does your home? Yes. Does your cat or your dog? Well, some kids have a high, you know, pedigree. Yes. Some kids, no, it's a mutt. So when we, you know, the surfboard question, I also say, what about your surfboard has a price, but does surfing have a price on it? Does having fun with your friends have a price on it? No. All the kids write peace, you know? So I go through the oceans. No, peace, no. So they get it. They get that we value more things than money, okay? So as adults, you know, just off the top of your head, just give me. Okay, I'm going to point to somebody randomly, so you better be thinking quick here. What do you like? What do you love? What makes you happy? Nature. Kevin.
My health.
Your health. Yes, here.
Ocean, mountains, and water.
Quit cheating. You looked at the kids. Way in the back.
Hugs.
Okay. Yes.
Community.
All right. Now, I have done this exercise in 28 states around America. This is a consolidation of what I have found. This is urban areas, rural areas, indigenous communities, non-indigenous communities, affordable homes, living wages, retirement security. Looks a little different in a Native community because it's about the time to teach the children how to pass on the culture. Fishing community, our fishing permits retain their value. Community outside, IRA, right? Savings account. But it's all retirement security. Affordable health care, safe neighborhoods, quality family time, affordable healthy food. I point out to the kids, okay, we didn't say candy, okay? Clean water and air. And I show the kids what the adults are saying after the kids do their exercise. We're all basically saying the same thing. What we really are talking about here is a quality of life, a way of living, and a way also of passing the planet on so that there's a sustainable future, there's a sustainable element to all this. So if you look at these values, and this is an exercise I do with the kids as well, on their pieces of paper, we say how, well, home, a surfboard, that has a price tag on it. So that's economic value. These values, these things that we love, they fall into three types of wealth. There's the economic wealth, the social wealth, people getting along, hugs, okay, quality family time. There's the environmental wealth. The ocean, mountains, water, air. That's all important to us. And in a democracy, human values count. And these three types of wealth weave together the economic, the environmental, the social, to form a quality of life, a living economy. That's important for us as humans on this planet. What we've come to realize is that maybe it's not all about money. This is what we're teaching the college students now. We're teaching full cost accounting, or a different way of growing wealth, where you can grow the economy in a way that makes all three forms of wealth go up, or at a minimum, one go up, but the other two stay neutral and don't decline. So when I do this exercise with fifth grade kids, I say, let's think of different industries, okay? And of course, I've already talked about oil. Oil is my main driver, okay? I'll be honest about this. We ought to get off oil. And I say to the kids, okay, we're going to go through each of these. We're going to take an industry. I do logging. I do all kinds of them. And I go, thumbs down if it's bad for wealth. Thumbs up if it's good. Neutral if it stays the same, okay? So let's do oil, okay? Be with me here. What does oil do to the environment? Okay, thumbs down. What does it do to social? Remember, social is about people getting together, being happy, right? Down, okay? What does it do to the economy? Up, the way we currently measure it. Two downs and an up. All right, not so good. Can we do better? What about this green collar job stuff? What about alternative energy? What is that? What is solar? What is wind? What is, well, okay, down a little bit on the environment, but let's not be too particular here. Relative to oil, okay? What does it do for the economy, okay? Economic, up. What does it do for social? You get people working together, up. What does it do for the economy? Up. Did I say social? What did I say? Anyway, we basically get all three up. Get it. We can attach our values to our businesses. This is what we need to do. This is about making our values count. And I'm going to tell this story now. This is still the fifth grade class. This was a great class. This was an open alternative school in Santa Barbara. One little boy, he was very obsessed with wanting to protect the ocean. How do we do it? And I said, okay, I'm going to ask you at the end of my talk. So This is near the end, but it's close enough for this story. And so I asked him. I said, okay, how do we protect the ocean? And he got very quiet for a minute, and then he said, we make businesses that increase social wealth and environmental wealth and grow our economy. A fifth grader. Okay? And I'll have you know that a teacher rushed up to me afterward to say that that boy was autistic and he didn't talk in class. Yeah. So if fifth graders can get it, you'd think we could manage this, right? Okay. Other countries are managing it. Europe prioritizes not economic wealth, but social wealth. They prioritize social wealth because they pay for sick people. So they don't want sick people. They want healthy people. So Europe has recently, within this decade, okay, passed a series of restrictions, banning, actually, toxic chemicals in cosmetics, toys, cars, electronics. This MacBook, if there was a shipment of them to a Europe, it would be banned. It would be confiscated. They have green MacBooks over there. So what Europe's done is said we want to match our economy to some of our values. It's forced U.S. corporations and other corporations to create two streams of product. One stream with toxic chemicals for the U.S. market and without toxic chemicals for the European market, same product. Case in point, MacBook. Okay? All because we haven't put it in law. How do we stack up, we the U.S. as a nation here, compared to the other developed countries? Well, we're 35th in life expectancy. In other words, how well does this model work in other countries? 35th in life expectancy isn't so hot. Maybe there's another way to do business. 29th in infant mortality. Not so hot. In fact, this is not so hot measure of our healthcare in general. It's saying that we're paying more and getting less. And getting less all the time if you listen to the debates, man. 15th in gender empowerment. This is about women in Parliament or Congress. First in a couple things, okay? Incarceration and greenhouse gas emissions. Not so good. So if we are going to have no coal, no oil, no compromise, we're going to have to do something a little bit differently. If we want to grow a green economy, if we truly want meaningful health care reform, we have to reclaim our democracy. How are we going to do this? I'm happy to report that a year ago when I started this talk, I was suggesting that we amend the U.S. Constitution to affirm that only human beings have constitutional rights. As I went around the country, I realized that there are a lot of groups trying to do this. Not amend the Constitution, but take on the issue of corporate personhood, corporations having human rights. And we are now a movement. But before I get to that part of the story, I just want to say that if we are truly going to do a movement and amend the U.S. Constitution, where do we start? Where do we start this process? This is a huge process. We start with what Eleanor Roosevelt said. Where do universal human rights begin? They begin in small places, close to home. They are the world of the individual person, the neighborhood, basically, the school, the factory, the office. Without concerted citizen action to uphold these rights close to home, then we shall look in vain for progress in the rest, in the larger universe. So, when I was going around the country, I found other places that have realized at the local level that it's not working. Corporate rights are trumping human rights. Corporate voices are drowning out human voices. Our values don't count. We don't count anymore. So places like Shapley, Maine, over water right fights, Barnstead, New Hampshire, water, Blaine, Pennsylvania, uranium mines, Spokane, Washington tried to introduce a second Bill of Rights. Humboldt County, this is the largest jurisdiction now that has passed a law to abolish citizen initiative, to abolish corporate persons. And by that, I mean to affirm that only human beings have human constitutional rights. Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, is trying to pass a second Bill of Rights. Basically, the idea here is that people rule, not property. So, what has happened, and this is like the exciting news here, is that as a result of actually Citizen United being the sort of the ultimate challenge to First Amendment rights, if Citizen United goes down, there's basically, forget it. We pretty much lost the plot of our democracy. The democracy, there was a deep democracy retreat in October, and national activists came from around the country. We discussed amending the Constitution, and we decided that this really needed to happen. It needs to happen because we're losing on every front right now, and we're going to continue to lose on every front. Campaign finance reform, forget it, as long as the corporations have the ultimate voice. They'll be right back at the Supreme Court again trying to get around whatever reform is done. So until we say they don't have the right to do that, only people have First Amendment rights. So this deep democracy retreat, I'm telling you something that hasn't happened yet, okay? We are going to launch the campaign to legalize democracy, and we're going to do it probably next month. And it is about passing a constitutional amendment. Now, after a year on the road, I still do not have constitutional amendment language. I have some very good concepts, but the lawyers got involved, and it's all being hashed right now, but we will have it within the next month. What we are doing is we agreed to keep working community by community, county by county, just like this, because this is a huge education process, but we also agreed to look at what states have passed corporate personhood, in other words, have given human rights to corporations by constitution, and which states have done it by statute. Of the states that have done it by statute, which states have initiatives, citizen initiatives, and which don't. Of the states that have done it in statute and have an initiative, we are going to call them rogue states. And in Alaska, we are going to go rogue, okay? And we are going to encourage and work on a citizen's initiative to rescind the statute that grants corporations all the powers of a natural person. And we're going to try to get this on the ballot by next November. Okay, so this is breaking news. And the main driver of this will be Gershon Cohen, who is currently on vacation, the first vacation in over two decades. But when he comes back in January, we're going to be on this. So I'm hoping that... I'm sorry. And Gershon Cohen is the person who has successfully led the citizen initiative on cruise ships pollution to get the citizen oversight and basically enforce our water pollution laws for cruise ships. So he has a good history of citizen initiatives in the state. Now, one of the questions that I get asked most frequently by everyone from fourth graders on up is, what can I do? And what we're encouraging people to do is go to the website ultimatecivics.org, start a kitchen table democracy group. Kitchen table group is literally as simple as organizing a potluck dinner, downloading some of either the study guide, a talk, Thomas Lindsay's lecture, whatever will get you as a starting point to actually discuss democracy so that you have food for the stomach and food for the soul. We need to start basic education in America that our democracy has been hijacked, okay? And this starts with all of us figuring it out. I posted actually a review of Gangs of America. It's really quite good. But the bottom line is, and I'm going to try to figure out a way to video conference in with other people, not only me, but other people in the coalition as well. This is POCLAD. This is Women International League for Peace and Freedom. This is a lot of the mainstream democracy activists. There's a huge Facebook discussion. Over 4,000 people are on it right now discussing, of all things, democracy and what a constitutional amendment should look like. And also share information. We are going to be posting, this map actually is done. We're waiting for the splash page and the announcement and all that. But we have an interactive map that shows all the states in the, you know, it's a map. And you can highlight a state so that you can see what people in Denver, Colorado are doing and what people in Chapley, Maine have done and what the ordinance looks like so that you could just, like, take somebody's ordinance and write your own and just change the city names. Or a resolution. Or a letter to the editor. I mean, what are other people doing that works, that doesn't work? So these are just some of the things that are going on. I hopefully will be teaching a 5-credit class called Ultimate Civics, Restricting Corporate Power and Reclaiming Democracy. Why this huge effort? Our leaders have warned what will happen if corporations get control of the country. And basically, Franklin Delano Roosevelt warned, the liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to the point where it becomes greater than their democratic state itself. That, in essence, is fascism. Fascism is the merger of corporate and state power. We've got it. We need to change it. We need to break this merger of democracy and capitalism, not only for us, but for the ones who follow, if we even want a chance of passing on a sustainable planet, a sustainable future to these kids. We need to do some serious effort blocking for them as adults so that they can achieve their dreams of green jobs. So I hope you'll join the campaign to legalize democracy. Go to the website, Ultimate Civics, check it out. Thank you all.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with author, activist, and scientist Ricky Ott. Her talk, entitled The Democracy in Crisis, It's Time to Change the Rules, was recorded at the Snow Goose Theater in Anchorage on Wednesday, December 9th, 2009. KSKA would like to extend a big thank you to Daniel Sparks at 104.5, who provided audio for this week's edition of Addressing Alaskans with Ricky Ott. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.